Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, it's Craig Fowler here. Before we get to tonight's show, let me tell you about our sponsors for this week. Manscaped, the men's below-the-waist grooming champions of the world! Manscaped offers precise engineered tools for your family jewels, and they have just launched their fourth generation trimmer, the Lawnmower 4.0. Join over 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with this exclusive offer for you. 20% off and free worldwide shipping with the code TERRACE at manscaped.com. Now, I've been a massive advocate of Manscaped ever since I tried my first razor, as I no longer need to worry about nasty nicks when keeping my pubic region nice and neat. But let me tell you about the latest upgrades. The improved trimmer includes a multifunction on-off switch that can engage your travel lock, means it doesn't start vibrating in your bag. It also gives you the ability to turn the LED spotlight on and off when you need it for a more precise shave. The Lawnmower 4.0 even allows you to customize your trim through additional guard lengths with sizes 1 to 4. And how about wireless charging? The new wireless charging system uses electromagnetic induction, which can help battery length last longer. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code TERRACE at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code TERRACE. Unlock your confidence and always use the right tools for the job with Manscaped.
Hello and welcome to Monday's edition of the Terrace Scottish Football Podcast. If you are aware, you'll know my voice. I'm Tony Anderson, and I am fortunate on a very special week to be joined by Tom Watt. Hiya, Tom.
Hello. How are we doing?
I am wonderful. I just got back from Copenhagen, as I probably told, so I had a grand time, feel rejuvenated. I feel like I got to do something. But enough about me. We have a man who is about to get married on Saturday. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it was meant to happen last September, but because of the unpleasantness, we've pushed it back a year. And by the skin of our teeth, they announced that folk from the UK can go to Italy. So we're going to go to Italy for a couple of weeks and might even try and take in a football match. We'll see. I don't know if the fiancé knows about that, so keep that on the down low. But
I think in a 2-week window.
And you'd think.
You can gather, what, an hour and a half for the match, the travelling, the bit around it. 4 hours around football?
About that. I think that's fair. I mean, the only thing is, so we're the one I kind of earmarked is like, Fiorentina are away when we're in Florence, so I can't do that. But Empoli's just like 20 minutes outside of Florence, and Empoli are playing Sampdoria. So my other half was like, okay, show me what what's nice in Empoli? And I found a video which was like the best parts of Empoli. And the first 2 minutes was just the football stadium. Like, the football stadium, nice little town square. The station, very beautiful Tuscan countryside, and then more of a football stadium. So we'll see.
I've got a feeling that your soon-to-be wife isn't zipped up the back, Tom, and knows exactly what's happening with going to Empoli.
I think it's fair enough. I think, I mean, when I originally floated it, I was like, oh, there's a couple of games around about. There's Inter Milan against Fiorentina, but that's a week later. There was a Chievo game maybe, or Roma, I think we're at home, but when we were looking at different places to go. But I'm just happy to be going away. If we get the football, even better. I'm going to sit in a pub somewhere and watch some Serie A.
Yeah, because it's man, it's the same. If I start telling her we're going to see Juventus v Rome or Roma v Lazio, I can maybe, like, there'd be a tint of excitement. But maybe when you start going into Empoli, it's...
Liam Henderson's there.
Yeah, exactly. He delivers. Tell her that. And everything will be A-OK. I was in Denmark when the Scotland game came. I couldn't get tickets. But I met some of the Tartan Army. And like, mine was just a holiday. The only thing I'd done was watch the game in an Irish bar. And the rest of the time I was trying to be rather cultural and sort of potter about Copenhagen and do it as a holiday. But yeah, I met some of the Tartan Army, five of them or something, who managed to get over. They were quite annoying. The stories about losing their phones in Slovenian stadiums. And that there's no, like, there was no punchline or anything. Just, I lost my phone in my wallet. And that was it. I mean, that just sounds bad, man. There's no sort of, like, there's no punchline, the humour of what happened, just being absolutely wrecked in a stadium.
You're not a proper foot soldier of the Tartan Army unless you've lost something of incredible value in a Central or Eastern European location.
Yeah. So they said they got tickets, so I hope they enjoyed it. But before we go into talking about the game on Saturday against Moldova, which we are here to talk about, as well as number 20 on the list of the 50 most memorable Scotland games, arguably this one might be the most memorable for various reasons. But I need to mention the review from the Terrace, which I'm sure people listening might have noticed on our Twitter feed and Facebook, which is a really exciting time for the podcast in general. And it's something that's been in the works for a long time. I know you've been involved, Tom, and done a few. And it's something we're really proud and excited to be getting into, because we believe that there might be room for this.
Yeah, it's been good fun. We've done a good few. I don't want to give too much away, but yeah, you'll get to hear us talking about things that we like and don't like quite so much, and a couple of things that I downright hated, and a couple of things that, if you know, yeah, the sort of an insight into the shit that we chat in the WhatsApp group.
Yeah,
but on all things music and football, and now music and football and films and TV and all sorts.
Yeah, and even wrestling.
Wrestling
one. A View from the Turnbuckle being the name of that. So right now we're just going to be floating a Peep Show podcast. So there's 10 episodes of a Peep Show podcast that about six or seven of us have been involved in. Fowler and his cousin are doing a Still Game podcast, which is exciting and very Scottish. We've got the Scottish Rewatchables, which is us reviewing movies of Scottish heritage. Some of them are very tenuous links, but we've went for them nonetheless. And then as Tom mentioned, we'll be doing a music podcast. So these will be evolving and changing as time, but as Tom said, it'll be music, wrestling, TV and movies. And now it's just a review from the Terrace. So we can branch out whatever we feel that people might be interested in hearing us talk. I can't wait till we get into the things we're really uneducated about. Can't wait for a gaming one. That'll be fun. But Fowler, of course, would like you all to subscribe to it and tell all your friends about it and leave us all the 5-star reviews on iTunes. And that is me begging. We want this to work really well. So we've got more people than just us involved, and we're looking to branch that out. So it's a really exciting time for the podcast. And if it's someone that's been listening to us for a while, like I know some of you will be, we really appreciate your support all these years. And another push, and maybe you might find something else interesting apart from me and Tom talking about St. Johnston's back three, or
maybe we should maybe mix it up one time and go from St. John, so from St. Johnston to the new film by Darren Aronofsky.
But anyway, we are here to talk about Scotland Moldova to start with, which all round, Tom, was a pretty, let's be frank, it was a dire night, even though we got out with the 3 points.
It was grim. It was grim viewing. It was painfully boring. Like, we can get the positives out of the way. We won, and there has been a time when a win over Moldova wasn't a given, and Billy Gilmore was really good. Other than that, we were kind of like that. Anything other than a win was completely unacceptable. We were looking for a bit of a performance, a bit of cohesion, something approaching a fuller house at Hampden, and to give them a bit of joy, to play a bit of football, to score a few goals. I mean, it's a Moldovan side that have been absolutely leaking goals right, left and centre. And to just, you know, to turn it on a bit, to show that there was a bit of spark about this team. And there wasn't really an awful lot to get excited about at all. I mean, Lyndon Dykes scores, Scotland go 1-0 up early on. And we were kind of expecting at that, I mean, certainly I was expecting, right, okay, anything less than like a 3-0 win is just not really even par for the course. And there were just too many on the night that didn't click, that couldn't find anything above a second gear, with a couple of notable exceptions. And yeah, we won. Yeah, we move on to the game midweek against Austria, which is at the very least a must not lose game. Probably, I would like to think that given the way that they're playing at the moment, we hope for a little bit more than that.
Oh, for the jugular, really.
Well, I mean, if Israel are putting 5 past them, and if history over the last 3 years has shown that we are nothing if not as good as Israel, repeatedly as good as Israel, then yeah, you would hope that we would go for the jugular and we would take a fairly significant step towards at least finishing second. But Saturday was, I don't want to get too caught up in it because we won and yeah, we got 3 points, but there was so little to get excited about.
And what was frustrating for me in that is it wasn't a particularly experimental lineup.
No.
Maybe Nisbet getting his first start over Adams was maybe one. Patterson coming in, although, I mean, most people, if they don't want him to be the starting guy, he's on the brink of becoming that guy regardless. The back three was pretty much the back three that we're expecting going forward, and then McGinn was back and Gilmore was in the team. So we're really kicking about that being our best team. in all honesty, that is. And to see that not click, to see the shape not work again, starting to, how long, I mean, I know the guy's done this to the death, maybe on a podcast recently. How long would you, Tom, be sticking with this shape, which frankly, it's not work. It's not really given us performances, even if it has at times brought us a few results.
I think it's tricky because I think there is more to it than just the shape. I think there were flickers of the shape working really well. I think when we had, I can't even remember which game it was, but when we had Dykes and Forrest with McGinn pushed up quite close as the sort of front three, if you will, mm-hmm. that that seemed to have quite a lot of promise. There's, you know, you've got Endeavor, you've got someone who's direct, you've got someone who can kind of arrive late in the box and can get in behind. And at that point, I thought, right, this is obviously the way that things are going, and this is the way forward. I also think that when Steve Clarke came in, the biggest question was, how do you get Andy Robertson and Kieran Tierney into the same team? He's got that, and he's got that, and it largely has worked. Worked in the sense that we're getting a fair amount out of our two best players. Like, we didn't necessarily on the Saturday, but in the system, I don't think that there's not going to be any questions at any point anymore about Kieran Tierney in the back three and Andy Robertson playing in front of him. So I think, to that sense, those are solved problems.
Yeah, and it also allows, we've got a big tactic as Tierney is a sort of attacking centre half, as you like. That's clear, and it does seem to work. I can see why. I know a lot of people want to see Tierney maybe on the right of getting them both in, but I personally feel like that takes away his main attribute, which is his ability to go on the outside and get to the byline and put in really good crosses from that area. If he's always coming inside, and I'm sure he could play 1-2s, and I'm sure he could drive into the box, but I feel like he'd be taking away his best attribute while still having his weaker attribute of defending a back post as a wing back would still be apparent. So I don't really know how much we gain from it personally. I know there'd be many people out there who would disagree with that. I agree. Miggin, I think we are going to see maybe pushing him forward. It'll be interesting to see if McTominay would come in into the midfield, or if he goes back into the back three. And Ryan Christie, again, he's had some... His Scotland form was surviving during the hell that was his Celtic season last season, but that's now... He's had good moments this season for Celtic, even though he still had some really poor games. It's like how... The really frustrating thing with Christie is he's got such a really high ceiling and a really low, like, point of, like, his worst position, his worst points. And that's really because you're getting, like, the gulf in what you can get and what you do get sometimes is incredibly frustrating.
I think so. And I think, personally, more than the system, more than the formation, and I don't know if this is something that Steve Clarke can address, has to address, is in any way responsible for, but all too often for Scotland, good players who we know have been playing well or have had a good run, at least for Scotland, just haven't turned up in key games. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for 18 months, Don McGinn was kind of, everything was running through him and everything good that we did was going through him. At the moment, it's not working for Ryan Christie. A year ago, it wasn't working for Andy Robertson. When he first kind of went into the back three, Scott McTominay, it just wasn't working for him. There's other examples. I don't think it worked for Nisbet at the weekend either. And I think maybe we need to look a little bit more at the players who are... Like, international football is not just about building a squad. Sometimes it's just about who's hot at the moment. So maybe, you know, Christie has not had a good run of form for a good wee while. Maybe we should have given Turnbull more... Mm-hmm. You know, more minutes, because he has started the season incredibly well. Maybe we need to, McTominay not being available at the moment, but maybe we need to mix the midfield up, push McGinn forward.
When he was at his best previously.
Yeah exactly. You get the few times that I didn't think he had a particularly bad game. I just don't think he was able to impact the game that way that he would have a year ago. And the few times that you saw, right, that's what he's doing best, was when he was breaking from midfield. Like the Moldovans couldn't get the ball off and they were incredibly poor. And even when they upped the pace a little bit in the second half, there weren't really a huge threat. But the few times that John McGinn got on the ball and was able to sort of break from the halfway line into their half showed where I think he's been most effective for Scotland. So, like, personally speaking, I don't think the problem necessarily is the formation. I think that there's just too many. Callum McGregor, another one, who just for one reason or another haven't turned up. And if three or four of them don't turn up in any one match, especially in a game when you just need somebody to raise the tempo a little bit. You're going to get games like this when everyone's... I mean, Moldova looked relatively happy with a 1-0. We were all, right, we've won this game, let's get on. And there is a little bit of that, but you need somebody to go, right, I'm going to take charge of this.
I think you've made a really good point about never being able to get anyone on form at the same time. So, like, as you said, Robertson a year ago struggled, but then towards the Euros and in the Euros, he was pretty good and he had some really good performances. As you mentioned, McGinn, towards last year, Christie had a really good period, and then he comes off at the same time. And then Callum McGregor, as I said, is another really good example. The only person that seems to have just come in and just been good right away with no mucking around is Billy Gilmore. And he's a pleasure to watch. He's in terms of pure talent, he's just as good as we've produced in a long time, I think. And he just doesn't look like a Scottish football player in any style at all. And it's exciting that maybe we've got guys, maybe like maybe not as good as him, but maybe more in the style of that real comfort on the ball, not just good on the ball like McGinn or McGregor, but actually like real top notch, can play short, can play long, can dictate a tempo. Because Gilmore's the kind of guy that can help us go away from home in games against maybe not the very best to win, although he proved that against England during the Euros, but against those teams like Austria, the teams that you want to compete with, but it's still really hard to go away and for us to win. Suddenly with a guy like Gilmore, he gives you a chink of light where, well, maybe you could, because we could just keep giving the ball to him, playing off him. Similar, and I mean, if you bring Ryan Jack back in, I mean, some people might not like me saying this because I'm talking about Rangers, but I start seeing that maybe you could get a vibe like what Rangers have in Europe when it's Jack, Kamara, and Davis, and they go away from home in Europe, and suddenly they're able to compete really well in tougher grounds, because really the possession starts to get to like 50-50, even goes more towards you. You're never under the cosh for too long, and you can really sort of play your way into the game and obviously create some chances.
I think that's a really good point. I think Scotland, there are a number overall, and this is not a slight on Ryan Jack, there are a number of overall more talented midfielders in the Scotland squad than Ryan Jack, but I don't think there's another one like him.
Yeah.
I think like him missing the Euros was such a huge loss, because we don't have anyone like him that does what he does. I think with Gilmore, he was the one player who understood when to slow things down and understood when to like break with the ball, when to speed things up. Like, and I don't want to get I don't want to get carried away, but like what Luka Modric did to us in the Euros, when it was like, right, this needs to go sideways, we need to take the sting out of this and kill this now, right? Now we're going to go 100 miles an hour and I can do this. And I can make this happen. Like, he's a long way from that, obviously. But he was the one player who, admittedly against inferior opposition, was able to go, right, like I just need to take control of this, not give the ball away, play a simple pass. Now I know what I need to do. Right, okay, I'll sidestep this man and I've got space to run into. For me, the most impressive thing that he did all game, like he should have scored. He had
two good chances, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the one in particular it was all his own endeavour, so fair enough, but just a bit of a cooler head, or maybe letting the ball come across him and hit the outside of your foot to the opposite post. But for me, the most impressive thing, and I haven't seen a Scottish player do this in maybe 30 years, was part of the way through the first half when the ball went over his head out on the left-hand side, and he took one touch to kill it and then another to move it away from his body. And we've not had a midfielder, like a central midfielder, who was doing that sort of thing and would want to do that sort of thing. Like, it was so patient. It was so
natural.
Yeah. The way that like the very best players seem to be playing the game at their own pace, the way that like, and again, I'm not getting carried away, I'm not comparing him to these sorts of players, but like the way that a Zidane or a Modric or players like that that just seemed to be doing things at a totally different pace to everyone else around about. They seem to have more time. They seem to make more, like time does something different around them. And not getting, but if Gilmore can keep doing what he's doing, if he can keep developing, if he can get a good season of first team football in the Premier League with Norwich this season, go back to and force his way in at Chelsea, then there is no reason why Scotland can't build a team around him. He was the one thing that he was the one player who was making things happen every time he got on the ball.
And then the exciting thing that would come with that is, as I said, with Jack coming back, hopefully getting back to his abilities, and that maybe McTominay ends up going into the back three. I think that is where he will end up. He was starting to edge back towards that in recent games before he got injured. And then McGinn can push into that attacking midfield role. And then you've got the debate about whether you play sort of Christie, Dykes or Adams, and maybe one of your quicker players like Fraser or Foster in a Fraser or Forrest in like a front three, or you go natural front two with Dykes and Adams, and it starts to the parts start to make a bit more sense, maybe. And then like that midfield, Gilmore and Jack sounds like the sensible midfield that we need in there. That maybe Gilmore and McGregor, but again, we've discussed that McGregor, not every game. I'm not saying he's shit in every game. I mean, he had some great games recently in Serbia, especially, and during the Euros, he had some decent games. Mm-hmm. But we can't ignore the mountain of bad games he's had as well. But before criticising, I thought before we move on and stuff, we need to talk about maybe the other two players who sort of been very, very new on the scene. Patterson and Nisbet, who they did, despite Nisbet not really, he didn't look like he was in tune with the rest of the team. And that's something that I'm happy to wait and see, because it is a tough one. I mean, we're asking Nisbet to move up a level almost every single season the last 3 years. So I am happy to sort of bide my time on that, even though I'm still not sure he is quite good enough to be up front for Scotland, but in terms of in tune. But he did show two major signs of quality. He created sort of Scotland's two best opportunities, the one that led to the first goal, which was sort of great from Patterson. You see everything you want from Patterson, driving, playing a 1-2, having the freedom to go into the box and without, and then sort of hitting a clever shot early from the pass in Nisbet, and then obviously Dykes falling in and scoring. I don't know, is there anything you'd like to say about those guys?
Yeah, I mean, I was impressed with Patterson largely. I think he had especially in the first half, I think he had a couple of little defensive lapses in the second half, but I think going forward, I think he did enough that if everybody's fit, he will be Scotland's first choice right back for the
foreseeable.
For the foreseeable. I don't know how long he holds on to that. I think eventually you need to break into the Rangers team or find football elsewhere, because there will be others that come up that, you know, we need him to keep developing at the top level, because from what we saw from a very young player, especially going forward, he's the best option we've had for, I don't know, 13, 14 years since mm-hmm. like peak Alan Hutton.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there's an awful lot of promise there. Nisbet probably has a bit more wiggle room, because Scott, the one area we still don't have a huge amount of quality is in the forward areas, I think.
Yeah, so he will get time in that.
He will get time, and he will get the possibility to, you know, to more training time on the pitch, like more. He will be in and around more squads, because there aren't a huge amount of other Scottish strikers. There aren't a huge amount of other Scottish strikers who are within a sniff of the Scotland squad at the moment. I think my kind of summary with the whole thing is, a couple of years ago, the frustration was we just don't have enough good players. The frustration with Saturday is we have a lot of very good players, even missing the bunch that we had through injury. Mm-hmm. That is still a very good squad with players playing at a very high level. We need them to start clicking. We need to be doing more to get the most out of what's a pretty talented group.
Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it a bit strange, one about Clark getting the new contract. It's not that I personally would have done it, but I just didn't see the rush. He still had something to prove. He still has to prove that, yes, he managed to get the results and get us over the line to get to a tournament, which is a big, huge green tick. But getting us playing a style and a consistent sort of shape where we all know exactly what's going to happen when we watch a Scotland team. He's not achieved that yet. And that's what deserved a new contract, in my opinion. That's what that would, if he'd got us firing and us looking sort of like, you know exactly what you're going to get when Scotland train, and we're not going to take a tanking off anyone. We're really going to be able to go toe-to-toe and go to Denmark, for example. And I'm not saying win, but you're not sitting there basically just fearing for your life. You're going there thinking, if we catch someone on a slight off day, then we've got the ability and the cohesion to take advantage. Something that's been a big scene part of the game is we seem to see Robertson turn up in the box and around the box quite a lot, and Patterson. So those wing-backs get involved very heavily. And I just wanted to talk about the frustrating thing I have when Andy Robertson. We seem to get Andy Robertson into better attacking positions shooting wise than maybe any other player on the pitch, and he can't fucking do it, man. And it's always the same error of not getting his knee over the ball and drilling it. And even when he hits it on target, he hits it high towards the bar of the goalkeeper's throat, or it goes miles over the bar. And that's really starting to annoy me, because as I said, the way our shape and everything works is he's the guy that's getting in there.
It is frustrating. I think there's two sides to that. One of them is, like, just next time we've got Scotland training, just throw the ball at Andy Robertson 12 yards out with a bit of pace at it and just get him to keep practicing hitting it across the goalkeeper. Mm. Just keep doing that, keep practicing.
Because he might not get to do that at Liverpool. Like, because with us, it's different because we have him pushing inside. We have him pushing inside a bit because we have Tierney coming up. So there is a subtle difference that Robertson will get near the goal.
And he's an out and out left back at Liverpool. Like his attacking position is far deeper than it's expected to be for Scotland. The other thing, though, is if it's Andy Robertson who keeps arriving late, and it's Andy Robertson that's getting on to the end of things, you have far bigger problems than Andy Robertson finishing. Like, we should not be reliant on one of our wing backs getting on the end of things when there are nominally there are two strikers on the pitch plus Ryan Christie, and I don't think you can ever class Ryan Christie as a central midfielder.
Right, so what do you think about Tuesday? Very quickly, Tom. Tomorrow night.
I hope we go for the jugular. I hope, like, they need a result, but this is not the Austria that their manager's under incredible pressure. They've got a couple of injuries. I wouldn't imagine they're going to be as bad as apparently they were against Israel. But I would hope that we're not just right, camp it, play for a point. We can't line up as openly as we did against Moldova. We do have a couple of injuries, a couple of players that pulled out, which will mean that we have to shuffle things around a little bit. But this is not this is not the Austria that we thought we had when the group was drawn. At the moment, you know, treat it like showdown. When you get any group, if you can hit 20 points, then you are in with a very good chance. If we beat Austria, we should be on course, barring some sort of fuck up that only Scotland tend to do, to at least hit 20, 21 points. And you know what? If you hit 21 points and you don't finish second, fine. The gods are against you. But a draw tomorrow, and we're probably, even if everything goes our way, we'd still be looking to get something from Denmark in the last game, which I'd rather not be in that position. Whereas very quickly, and you've got total recency bias with international football, very quickly, if we get a result tomorrow, we'll get a result against Austria, then this international triple header has suddenly got a very, very different spin on it.
Yeah, I mean, things can change overnight. Us bitching and moaning and here, yeah. on a Monday evening, and then the guys on Wednesday or Thursday sort of celebrating a sort of pretty one massively important result. And that's what can maybe kick a team into gear and maybe find that identity that I talk about that we are searching for. But let's go all the way back, Tom, to the 10th of September 1985, where David Bowie and Mick Jagger had a number one single with Dancing in the Street. And we also, number one movie was Back to the Future, Tom, which I'm sure is a favourite of yours like everyone's.
It is. It's a favourite of everyone's. It's now classic cinema. It's properly good, you know, properly concrete, 100% classic cinema now. Yeah, love it.
And that was for the 1986 World Cup, UEFA Group 7 World Cup qualification. And we're going to be talking about what is looked at about an incredibly somber night, where Scotland drew 1-1 with Wales away. And like, the bit that caught me about this, Tom, was away even from the Jock Stein stuff, it sounded like just so much was going on in British football at this time.
Yeah, politically, really interesting times. Football in general had kind of slight two sides to it. On one side of it, the football hooliganism, not just in England, but the focus very much on England and the worst examples of it in England had meant it was just shortly after the Heysel Stadium disaster. So there was a real focus on British football, and, you know, don't want to say that Scottish football didn't have its hooliganism elements at the time either, but there had not been an incident like that. And I think initially, off the back of Heysel, British teams across the whole of the UK had been banned from European football, and that had been rescinded. But unfairly, the government at the time in the UK had a real problem with football for political reasons. Just very interesting times, very turbulent times politically, very divided, a very divided time, especially if you were not in South East England, really.
It seemed, I mean, one of the last things Jock Stein done was sort of argue back against Margaret Thatcher, because he felt that British football fans, there was going to be a crackdown on them, and he could sort of tell what was coming, and he sort of tried to use his stature, which was obviously huge at the time, to argue against it. And in terms of the Welsh FA, it looked a really tough time for them. Like, we'd scrapped the home internationals, so the Welsh FA were in a really poor financial state. They'd desperately got Cardiff to be chosen as a venue. And then Alan Evans said it was literally life or death. It had to be at the Cardiff Arms Park. And a 62,500 crowd would ensure profits of over $500,000. But they got bumped off from that in the end, which by the Welsh Rugby Union, they didn't want to host a football event after what had happened in Heysel. And there's something that's quite upset, I find, a bit, and it's the same here. I think we still not, aren't there. Sort of, our sports don't seem to come together at all to support each other. So you're talking about, like, the Welsh FA talk about life or death, and they're in such a poor financial state, and they'd had so many close. So I imagine when you qualify for tournaments, there's big money involved for the FA, and they'd had some close hits. I mean, they'd missed out due to last minute goals. They'd missed out due to goal difference, which happened again in this tournament, and this game went a huge way to making sure that happened. But it's just interesting to see all that time ago, and I still don't see sort of like rugby union in Scotland or the SFA really coming together at any point to do it with our clubs or vice versa.
No, very, very divided worlds politically, I think, and I don't think it's always the case. I mean, there are. It definitely is the case in some parts of the world as well, but I think in large parts of Western Europe, there's either no one single national stadium, or if there's big government funded municipal stadiums, then they're multi-use. But I think there's probably less so in Wales, but there's certainly some quite deep seated political division between, certainly between rugby and football.
Yeah, I mean, it borders into class, which is probably like one of the the biggest dividers in the, I'm not sure, I mean, it's all over the world class, but I always feel the UK is really divided by class. But enough about the politics. I mean, let's go to the game. Scotland lined up with sort of like, we had Jim Leighton in goals, who had to come off at halftime because he'd lost his... He sort of couldn't, he was dropping crosses, and it turned out that he'd lost one of his contact lenses. And it was a really funny story that no one really knew about that. And Jock Stein certainly didn't. And so Jim Leighton was possibly the last man to ever feel the true wrath of Jock Stein on the day, because apparently he absolutely lost the plot at halftime with Jim Leighton.
As well you might. I mean, they hadn't told Sir Alex Ferguson, who had been his manager for what must have been seven, eight years previously. And, you know, you would think that that's a fairly fundamental thing you tell your manager at some point.
But you always have extra at the touchline and stuff like that. You think you would have stuff like that.
And these are not like... This is not back in the day when people had contact lenses and, oh, you have like another couple in your bag. These are like back in the ye olden steampunk contact lenses, which were like forged in volcanoes. Not quite the same thing. So, yeah, he lost a contact lens and had to be subbed at halftime for Alan Ruff.
Alan Ruff came on, and we'll not go too much into Alan Ruff. I mean, he took a bit of a beating on here the last time about him trying to steal beef from Safeway. So we'll leave old Ruffy alone this time. But we also had the Dundee United duo of Richard Gough and Maurice Malpass, and then Roy Aitken of Celtic. So it's quite a defensive team, this. I mean, there's five defenders in there, out-and-out defenders, you would argue. Roy Aitken, Alex McLeish, and Willie Miller. Scotland went to this despite being in a much stronger position than Wales, because Wales sort of lost their opening two games to Iceland and Spain. And obviously everyone, Spain, I think, had been finalists in the last Euros or World Cup. So they were sort of expected to go and win it. So it was thought of as a bit of a straight shootout between Scotland and Wales, and Iceland would be at the bottom. So, but we went in not quite as favourites because we were missing quite a lot of players, apparently. And maybe that lends itself to why we had sort of five, because there are five guys you can hang your hat on in terms of Scotland. They're big names in that team. It's at McLeish and Willie Miller. Then you go into the midfield, had Steve Nicol from Liverpool, Gordon Strachan, who was at Manchester United by this time, and Jim Bett, the Aberdeen legend there. And then up front, where I think is safe to say is maybe where we were lacking a bit, was Graham Sharp and David Speedy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the 86 squad is arguably the best group of players that we're not necessarily for this game individually, but like that was a hell of a group of players, regardless of like the level that the Scottish teams were at domestically and where they were playing if they weren't playing domestically. And we could kind of have, like you say, there were issues up front, but you know, we could afford to be missing, you know, your Graham Souness's and your Kenny Steve Dalglish. Archibalds and yeah. Kenny Dalglish, Alan wow. Hansen. You know, like you could
look
afford
at that. Yeah, like, that's a great point. Look at that defense, and you're still Alan Hansen to sort of come into that.
Pretty wild that, but this was a very, very good Welsh side as well. Neville Southall, Pat Van Den Howe, Kevin Ratcliffe at an Everton team that were one of the best in Europe. Mark Hughes, I think a year before he went to, was it a year before he went to Barcelona? It was a year before he went to Barcelona. Ian Rush, even there's kind of players that they had on the edge of things, you know, like your Clayton Blackmores and Mickey Thomas and David Phillips and players like that were very good players. You can kind of understand why Steen thought, right, we need a point. A point will do us. So we'll sit in, and we do have injuries, and we're maybe missing some of our more creative players. But it's a pretty dangerous game to be playing as well against a very, very good Welsh side. And it ended up that kind of came to pass because they absolutely battered us in the first half.
Yeah, you were mentioning that Everton team with Pat Vendenhout, and I've got a nice link for you. Obviously we mentioned that Mick Jagger was number one at this point. But he was married at this point to Mandy Smith, who is the former wife of Bill Wyman, the bassist of the Rolling Stones.
A seamless segue from Scotland's 1985 clash with Wales to the Rolling Stones.
They unfortunately did divorce in 1987 after and separated for 2 years, but I mean, it must have been cool to walk into Wales, into Cardiff, and be married to like the Rolling Stones bassist wife, even if it was short-lived.
I was going to say that she must have only been about like what 21 at that point, but I've just looked and she was about 21 at that point in her second marriage.
It was different times. It was different times. Yeah, and sort of like he wasn't the only character in that Wales team. Mickey Thomas, I would be remiss to not... I didn't realise this about Mickey Thomas, but he had some life, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you could say that. involved in counterfeiting and money laundering through Wrexham. Had spent 18 months in jail. I think he got stabbed in the arse as well.
Yeah, multiple times. It sounds, I was reading up about, that was one that caught my eye. You'll not be surprised to know, Tom. But yeah, it was like a businessman used his wife as bait to sort of like as a sex game to get Mickey Thomas in. And then once they were in there, the guy just came in and he sort of stabbed him in the arse and the body with a screwdriver by two men. And he was threatening to cut his penis and his ears off, and his legs would be broken. So let that be a lesson to anyone who's...
Let that be a lesson to you. But also, like a really, really good player, it must be said, I'm like a really, really good player. One of my... Just around about the time that I really got into football, the big giant killing in the FA Cup, when like the FA Cup was like a cool thing that if you grew up in Scotland, you still wanted to watch the FA Cup games. That kind of all-conquering George Graham Arsenal side knocked out the FA Cup by Wrexham, and Mickey Thomas must have been 40 years old scoring like an absolute screamer of a free kick. And I used to buy Shoot magazine whatever that was, 92 maybe, 93. And they had like a double gatefold centre poster of Mickey Thomas's free kick against the Arsenal game, which my brother had on his bedroom wall.
Was he the same one that scored the last minute goal that won Arsenal the league, or was it Liverpool the league?
That was Michael Thomas.
That was, yeah, is that different?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it was.
It was that team, that Arsenal team that needed to go to Liverpool and won 2-0. Mm-hmm. And then the next season, I think it's the next season, the last season, so I think it was the last season of the old First Division when the FA Cup was on. Arsenal played against Wrexham, and I've no idea what division Wrexham were in, maybe like, but it was not high, and Wrexham beat them 2-1, and the Shoot headline was Wrexham Wreckham.
Oh. But then unfortunately he ran into Jeffrey Dean's 30-year-old wife, Erica. He proceeded to have sex with her in a car in a field, and she escaped prison because she has two young children and is expecting another, and she was pressured by her husband in the plot. And she ended up just doing 180 hours community service.
And he got stabbed up the arse.
And he got stabbed. And then Edward and the judge told her that her conduct was shameful. I think she got off relatively lightly there. But I mean, I can imagine it's not too much of a reach to imagine the husband, businessman, being the one driving this and her probably being threatened herself.
I mean, I. I wouldn't want to speculate, but I think you're not, I mean, that's an entirely feasible version of
it. Right, so let's sort of get, but I mean, another character I really wanted to talk about, Tom, was Neville Southall.
Big Nev.
I mean, he's a dreamboat, really, isn't he? What a wonderful, wonderful man. It's like sort of just like totally shits on how people of his age are considered.
Yeah, I mean, his Twitter is just, it's fascinating. Like, he's everything you would, goes against everything you would expect from like a typical 1980s, I think still was playing into the 2000s, but, you know, a man in his 60s who had the best part of 100 caps for Wales. The antithesis of a kind of businessman shagging, arse-stabbing man of libertine. He's like incredibly progressive, seems to want to learn a lot more about the world around him as it's evolving, incredibly open-minded, and just seems like a good guy. He raises money for charity, works with disadvantaged children, does an awful lot about like still I think coaches youth teams in Wales, and I mean, like an unbelievably good goalkeeper.
Let's not forget that. Yeah, let's not forget that.
Like in his time, just an unbelievably good goalkeeper for who I think I'm right in saying played in four different decades at a very high level. Does a lot for charity, does a lot for progressive causes, does a lot for LGBT community. Just, yeah, not, if you were to paint a portrait, like to build a character of a footballer of that era, Neville Southall is the absolute opposite of that.
Like, yeah.
Teetotaler, level-headed, forward-thinking philanthropist.
Accepts that he's wrong. Like, he doesn't know everything, and he's happy just to be, because I love the idea that he doesn't, because it was a Donald McRae article that I was reading from 2018 when I was sort of looking it up. I think it was a Guardian article, and he was sort of angry about the article when he was doing it. He had to really beg him to sit down and talk to him about his career and about him, because that's what the article's made about, because he normally doesn't want to do that. He was hoping that the paper would come and he'd be able to shine the spotlight on, as you're saying, the LGBT community or drugs helpline, suicide bereavement, sex workers. And he's got, and so that's what he does with his Twitter feed. He basically just, he hands it over to someone. So he uses his sort of profile. So he's got 134,000 followers and he just plugs products. So you'll get someone on who knows more about it than he does, and inequalities in the world. And then they just take over his Twitter account for a couple of hours and he gets people to ask questions and he sits back and learn. And a beautiful thing to say, my kids were asking me questions about transgender community and LGBT. And he just admitted that he didn't know. So he just went away and got people to come and talk to them about it. And he's saying that he's a big advocate of, there's, if you can get these people together, you know, there's millions of people in that community. There's millions of transgender people, but they're all so separated. If you get them together, then suddenly you can make change, because you cannot listen to millions of people and the government would have to listen. And it's just, like I said, then Don McRae said he had to beg him to do it, because once he came, he nearly pissed off. He was like, no, I'm not interested. If it's just going to be the usual conversations that I have with journalists, that's not what I'm here for. And I mean, he's great fun. He's great fun as well. It's not like he's not preachy at all. He's just very accepting that he doesn't know. And I just really wanted to have a little bit of appreciation for Neville Southall, who's, as we said,
a good egg.
Yeah, they are the complete opposite of what you expect of a footballer coming out of the 80s. To be fair, the complete opposite. You know, a bit of football, he comes out in 2021. Unfortunately, that being the worst bit. But we went behind in this game, Tom.
Yeah, and really kind of struggled to get a foothold in the first half. We absolutely invited them onto us, and Mark Hughes caused all sorts of problems. Ian Rush scored for Wales. They had a couple of
No, it was Mark Hughes did it, not?
Oh, sorry, was it Mark Hughes?
Yeah, he scored his sixth goal in 10 games for Wales, and it was quite cool seeing him, because we all got to see him. You're slightly older than me, so you might, but I remember him sort of when he was coming more towards the end. I was kidding, but he was still fucking brilliant when I was growing up. He's like the sort of the greatest volleyer of a ball I've possibly ever seen, and he was so aggressive, but to see him like that, he must have been such a handful back then.
Like just a constant pest, and like quite dirty as well. Mm. But like, and the sort of player that if he was on your side, you'd just love him, because he was just a constant pest, moved around a lot. Like an unbelievable volleyer of the ball, really good at diving headers as well. Like just anticipated where the ball was going to drop. Like very, very few I've ever seen. Yeah, quite right. So he scored, but he was constantly causing problems. Wales had chances. Ian Rush probably should have scored. Jim Leighton had a couple of good saves from Mark Hughes, who probably should have scored again. And we were pretty lucky to only be one behind at halftime.
And then, as I said, Alan Ruff came on. We went in the second half, and then the big moment for us, really, if you look at it, is Gordon Strachan was taken off, and Rangers hero Davy Cooper was popped on the pitch. And then, safe to say, we got a dodgy penalty, Tom.
We got a dodgy penalty. I mean, we probably should have had a penalty. We probably should have had a penalty slightly earlier on. David Speedy was fouled in the box, and that looked quite like a penalty. But it's safe to say that we got a soft, soft penalty that, you know, allegedly David Phillips handled the ball. I don't think even the harshest of VAR referrals would suggest there was anything intentional in it, or any making. But, you know, like it doesn't even hit him on it. I don't know.
I enjoyed the commentary at that bit, because it's clearly a Welsh guy saying how harsh it is, and then a Scottish guy comes in. I'm not sure who they are. Scottish comes in. Right, but it definitely hits his arm.
Definitely. I mean, in fairness, it definitely does hit a part of his arm. We will say that. But we'll take it. You know, we'll take it.
And then you get the feeling that we maybe needed it in that game. We needed a break in that game. And then Davy Cooper got the goal, and Southall probably should have saved it, I would argue. When you get the replay behind the goals, he gets down more than early enough. He should actually probably save it quite comfortably.
Yeah, he was either unlucky or just didn't have enough conviction of what he was doing with it. But you know,
that must happen a fair bit as a goalie, because you maybe lie on the other foot and then you go for it, and then you're not sure. You're not quite as ready as you are when you're saving a shot from outside the goal. One thing I wanted to mention is how fucking good the crowd looked at these periods, like with all the flags, and it was like attendance was only like 39,500, but it was like one of those to me where it looked like it was 100,000 people in there and nobody had a seat and everyone was on top of it. As these videos so often do when you watch it and everyone going crazy. And it was a huge result for Scotland at the end, and it was sort of mean enough creeping towards securing our place at the World Cup at Wales' expense. And then, unfortunately, Jock Steen had collapsed after the game, and it was found out that he'd been quite unwell, or people thought he'd looked unwell, but being Jock Steen, probably didn't want to let anyone know and just knew he had a job to be doing.
Yeah, there had been kind of signs in the build-up, and Alex Ferguson had mentioned that he thought he looked like pale and sweaty and that things weren't right. It must be incredibly difficult. Like, I mean, it must be difficult at, you know, walking down the street, seeing someone who doesn't look well, but noticing somebody not looking well when you're in an incredibly stressful environment, when, you know, you need to hang on to when you care about it as much as Jock Steen obviously did. It's very easy to say, you know, why didn't anybody say, what's up? And it also transpired that he wasn't taking his medication as was advised, but for heart failure, just incredibly sad. The initial aftermath seemed to be that he was stable. He'd been kind of taken down the tunnel, and the doctors and the SFA staff had kind of tended to him immediately, and he seemed to be stable. But after he apparently seemed to be in a comfortable position, he was pronounced dead half an hour after the final whistle, and it just... Yeah, so from the highs of qualifying to one of the darkest days in Scottish football ever.
So it just seems so bizarre, because when you actually see him getting carried off, and he's got his eyes open, so you think he's all right, and if you don't know that he's unwell or anything, it actually looks like, see, if it's nothing to do with health, it looks like the most iconic photo. A video of all time of him being carried away by four policemen. If you don't know that he's unwell, like at first glance you would think he's done something really naughty, yeah. and they're dragging him off, and it's the proper old style police hats, and it actually looks, as I said, it could look like arguably like a really iconic video, but then obviously you find out that what's such. But I noticed that, it's the first time I had, when I'd looked at it, it was the first time I thought at first like that could just look like, wow, what an absolute legend. He's lost it at someone and they're taking him down.
Brian Moore, the commentator, had said that when he's taken off, that he was like overcome with emotion,
yeah,
because of it. And you can see why he thought that. And then obviously realising that it was a lot more serious than that.
Sad, sad day. And like you said, it's just, in a nutshell, and suddenly that game doesn't matter, much like... sort of with Liam Kelly when his father died at Kilmarnock, just puts everything in perspective. And I don't really think there's anything else to say really about it. And on that sad, somber note, I think we'll call it a night there. We're going to be moving over to Patreon to do a new series that we think is... we came up with off top of our heads today when we were looking for content. Let's be deadly serious. Let's be honest. It's going to be called Big Match Memories, which keeps it as broad as we like. And we're going to be talking this tonight, since it's me and Tom, we're going to be talking about maybe a bit of the history about Hibs and Aberdeen fixtures, a few of the classic games. It'll be very general, classic games, classic players. Maybe a bit of the history of the fandom. I mean, we're talking about football hooliganism here. I mean, Hibs and Aberdeen had some cracking, if you want to call them that, running battles in the 80s and sort of like, and I have a page that's dedicated to it that I found on Wikipedia that's just about Hibs hooliganism and the fights they had with Aberdeen. So if you want to come over and sort of listen to that Green Street stuff, then please come and join us. And we'll be talking at length about the classic games between Hibs and Aberdeen. But thanks very much for listening, and have a lovely evening. Say goodbye, Tom.
Bye. Sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's
ruined it.
Good night.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.